United States v. Oakham. And Mr. Protogiro, we'll hear from you first.
May it please the court, my name is Andrew Protogiro. I'm from Norfolk, Virginia. I represent the appellant, Edward Oakham, in this particular matter. That's before the court. This case was originally tried in the Richmond Federal District Court before Judge Payne. And there were four areas that were looked at with regard to the matter as it was tried. This was, for lack, probably the easiest way to describe it, what, and I'm sure the government would, it was something of a Ponzi scheme as to how it the evidence played out. Mr. Oakham factually was a real estate investor. He had been a real estate investor his entire life. As he got older, there was an opportunity to purchase these companies that had that held tax-free investment-type funds that allowed somebody to take the funds after a sale of real estate, put it into a typical trust type of scenario. They had so many days to withdraw that those funds to buy another piece of property, and that way they avoid the capital gains. Yes, sir. With regard to that, Mr. Oakham, as the evidence played out, had the opportunity, it seems, to purchase the tax-free side of the of corporations and in turn bundle them up, and the evidence was that he was taking those funds and using them to his own benefit, sometimes with his lavish lifestyle. Sometimes the evidence was that he would pay down debt and other expenses with regard to his corporation that was running shopping centers and other real estate ventures. The issues before us are four. The first issue dealt with, and this was tried before Judge Payne in the Federal District Court in Richmond. The first issue dealt with the denial of a Franks motion, Franks v. Delaware type motion, that was that Judge Payne wrote a lengthy memorandum opinion. And in fact, being a trial lawyer myself and not being the trial attorney in this case, Judge Payne's opinions are rather long, and they do cite, so it's difficult to come in and to argue the issues that Judge Payne does bring up in his memoranda in each of these issues. In fact, even on the continuance issue, I think Judge Payne wrote a three-page memoranda denying the continuance in this case, which is the fourth issue. In the Franks issue, of course, we have to look at whether or not the affidavit that it was provided by the postal inspector would give the adequate probable cause to the magistrate judge in this particular matter if we were to extract, let's say, the issues that would be either false or reckless disregard for the truth.
Can you point to any false statement in the affidavit?
Well, it's interesting you say that. I am bound, of course, by what the trial lawyers raised, and in reading and in preparing for this, the trial lawyers appeared to raise three issues of falsehood. The real question is one, whether it's falsehood or not, or it was just painted that way in the affidavit. One was, frankly, as it was raised at the trial by the trial attorneys, was whether or not they should be monies were held in nationally insured banks until invested by QI. It appears that there's very few contracts that really supported that. And I think of the total contracts they found at maybe 1% or 5%. And I think that was one issue he raised. The trial counsel also raised as to the whether it was truthful or not that the funds would be routinely withdrawn funds from the exchange accounts. And he also raised an issue as to whether or not they could be invested, or the type of investment that QI, meaning the corporation, could have for its own account. And I think Oakham would say the idea was it was his own account. The real issue is, even if you extract that, frankly, if you were to extract everything with regard to that, would the probable cause still remain there on the affidavit itself, or the warrant to be granted by the magistrate judge?
Well, it seems to me like the fact that whether he would eventually be able to repay the so-called victims was not material to the probable cause determination that he had obtained money under false pretenses.
I agree that whether or not, and the law does support that, and I can't argue that the law doesn't say whether he could repay them or not. I think that, in all the white-collar cases I've represented, usually the white-collar defendant is the one who, once the wheel stops, and once the wheel's going around and it stops at a sudden break, the white-collar defendant's always seeking to catch up. And that appears to be the case, not only here. And I'm not prepared to argue that that would be anything other than that.
What about his standing, considering the fact
standing is the issue, and I've jumped to the second issue because, frankly, this court hasn't really dealt with the standing issue per se.
What if he doesn't stand? I mean, if he handled it on the merits, the question is whether Frank's doctrine is violated. And standing is very interesting, but in this case, it makes any difference.
It may not. And in fact, and I have to say that in all honesty, as I have read this and prepared this.
You have standing. Yeah. You got a real uphill battle.
Exactly. And that's why I said, even if you extract those paragraphs, the investigator in this particular case, and I'm not really taking their argument, but I have to be maintain a semblance of credibility. I've been coming here 25 years. But even if you do look at it in that sense, even if you extract those paragraphs, I think it's like 14, 15, 16 in that ballpark in the affidavit, even if they were taken out, he was talking to CIs. In fact, there were two that he was discussing and had received information from with regard to that. So even if you had extracted that, I can't argue to you that it would be a close call. So the standing issue, even if you were to accept it, it may not make that other prong that would be required of the two-prong test that's needed to have a Frank's motion to be heard or in the evidentiary hearing. With regard to...
And all that would get you is an evidentiary hearing.
That's all it gets you. That's correct. And in this particular case, it was denied, and there was no opportunity. I think that they filed their brief, and within a month, it was denied by a written memorandum. The next issue that was raised was the denial of the dismissal of certain counts in this case, keeping in mind that certain counts were dismissed. Count 9 was dismissed, and count 16, 17, and 18, the original memorandum and brief that was filed by the defense counsels in this case was counts 1 and then 3 through 18. That's just how it was laid out at the time. There were certain counts that were dismissed either by the government or by Rule 29. With regard to that, the only issue really comes down to is whether or not it had been pled enough for the defense to be able to have tried the case and understand what the theories were.
Whether the indictment was sufficient.
Well, it's whether or not they understood the theories of the case and whether or not it was laid out appropriately. The problem, of course, and I have to lay it out from the defense perspective, is they were granted a bill of particulars because the initial memorandum was or brief was written in the alternative, dismiss or give me a bill of particulars. And in this particular case, they were granted a bill of particulars. Even though the law is that
the bill of particulars, the indictment supplemented by a bill of particulars was still faulty?
I would not necessarily say it was still faulty, but it can't correct what the original indictment, I think you have to look at the
like particularize.
It particularizes and it should give them the appropriate theories in preparing for their defense in the case. They ultimately did ask for a continuance. And that was denied. But in this particular case, does the bill of particulars in turn, does it correct the indictment itself? The indictment, frankly, is the classic indictment that we all see at the trial level from the feds. And in fact, it even refers back to, or from the government, in fact, it refers back to certain initial counts that lay out the purpose and scheme of the conspiracy. In this particular case, they did get that bill of particulars, and they still complained that it was not sufficient for them to be able to prepare the defense of the case.
Take those counts out of the picture. Jump ahead a little bit.
Yes, sir.
But how much time did he get on the other counts? Independent of the counts that he got challenged.
Judge, I did not go through and extract if I was...
Matter of count.
He right.
100 years altogether.
He got 1,200 to serve... 1,200 months to serve, and then another 1,200 to run concurrent.
But how much did he get on the other counts that you don't challenge?
Suffice to say, he got enough that he would remain in prison as he is. I didn't go through and calculate.
What's the material difference in it?
Most of those, I will say that the earlier counts were 240-month counts. As it got along near the end of the 27 counts.
Well, I've got to figure out, I think he faced 140 years on the other counts. But how much did he get on the other counts?
I didn't calculate it out.
Consecutive, whatever.
Right.
Maybe the government will know that.
I'm sure that they had an opportunity.
Put them on notice for that.
I'm sure they had an opportunity to calculate how much it would have been. I do know that when we looked at the...
Well, before you leave that argument, other than just in conclusive terms, how do you feel the indictment as supplemented by the bill of particulars was insufficient?
I don't think that to say it was insufficient. I think that whether or not the bill of particulars, even once it's granted, does that in turn clean up the indictment? Does it refer back?
To answer his question, give an example of a count that you don't think had sufficient custody.
I couldn't do that, Judge. Honestly, I can't. I frankly, if I had been the trial lawyer in this case, I don't know if I would have even asked the bill. So I to tell you that that's, I have to go by what they argued and as they laid it out. And I can tell you that this particular indictment, from this attorney, it would have been different. I can inform you of that. They complained that it would not have been, and therefore that's what I have. The issue of the sentencing, I can tell you that in examining it, of course, the issue comes down to whether or not a 100-year sentence on a individual who has never had a, at 58, triple bypass surgery, angina, no criminal record, whether or not that is...
guideline.
It would have been life. It was a life sentence. In fact, I think it read life on the PSR as you look at the...
Is 400 years less than life?
400 years is... Whether that's a legal question or a philosophical question...
Not philosophical. Philosophical.
400 years would be less than life, I would assume.
I would
All I know is that when I did look at
practical matters, not.
As I looked at it under the...
No difference.
It does. And I looked at it with regard to the guideline book. The level was off the chart as it was laid out. As you examine the book, this level doesn't even exist. So it was by far it was what it was. And that was because of the $127 million or so under the fraud that really moved his guidelines where it did, and then he got certain enhancements that went along with it.
So the guidelines give the district judge a range far above what was given in the state. That's a practical matter, not a matter. A lot of it is practical. But as a legal issue, the recommended guideline range is far beyond the sentence of the variance. 100 years
before. Yes, sir, 58. That is correct. And with the realization that there are other white-collar criminals that have received similar sentences, and that is understood at approximately the same time. And we have dealt with that in these courts. Lastly, with regard to the continuous issue, that's merely an abuse of discretion issue. It was raised by the trial counsel at the time as to whether or not the alternative theories that were raised or an alternative theory that was raised before trial would have been sufficient for them to have been able to prepare. There was an argument that they were not, and therefore Judge Payne ended up writing a 2 or 3 page memorandum with regard to same, explaining and in fact giving them certain concessions with regard to witnesses that they would have names of witnesses in advance. That being said, that's an abuse of discretion standard, as is the sentencing standard in this case.
So he had retained counsel at trial?
What it seemed was that you had, and I had spoken to the United States. I was appointed now, and I ended up having to go by what I had before me,
right,
and what was filed by the trial counsel. But what it appeared was there was the public defender's office, and then there seemed to be a special counsel that had been brought in to assist with regard to the accounting aspects of the case. And as frankly, as I see it, and as I've tried many of these types of cases, if you make it complicated, it's complicated. If you keep it simple, you do a lot better. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, sir. Up here. Mr. Goss?
May it please the Court, my name is Mike Fry, and I, along with Jessica Aber-Brumberg, have the privilege of representing the United States in this appeal. To answer the Court's initial question about whether there is a distinction even if you took out the counts that are complained of in the indictment. We do not know the exact numbers, Your Honor, but we did do a back of the envelope calculation yesterday and this morning, and with the concurrent counts, it appears as if on this were open sentence, even if those counts were dismissed that were complained of, there would be at least 100 years left on his sentence, is the government's position. This case, I think that the most interesting thing about this case that Mr. Progiro is discussing is the fact that there was a 100-year sentence for a white-collar defendant who supposedly had no criminal history, and he was 58 years old. And at first blush, that gets everybody's attention. But if you look at the facts of this case and what Mr. Okun did and the egregiousness of his conduct, and if you look at this supplemental joint appendix, which includes the victim testimony and the testimony of his former wife outlining his prior criminal history when he was in his 20s. The judge came to a reasonable sentence in this case. He had looked at all the 3553A factors. And what the judge said on the record was, after considering the seriousness of the offense, the characteristics of the defendant, the harm that was perpetrated against citizens in this, across the country, that he wanted to make sure that Mr. Okun never had the opportunity to do this again, and he wanted to make sure that there was a general deterrence message. And that's exactly what he did. The restricted guideline sentence in this case was 400 years. Judge Payne, in a very thorough sentencing hearing, put on the record that he found 400 years more than necessary to effectuate the 3553A factors and mentioned the general deterrence and specific deterrence. Now Mr. Okun comes before the court and awkwardly complains that he should have been sentenced to something less, an unspecified less, but there was no reasonable sentence. I think in the district court he argued for 10 to 15 years, Your Honor, but if you look at his co-conspirators, for example, Ms. Coleman received a 10-year sentence. That was after she pled guilty, and she received $1 million out of this personally. Mr. Okun took the vast majority of the money. In fact, he spent $40 million himself in his quest for a 131-foot yacht, expensive jewelry, cars for his wife and himself, luxury cars, Ferraris, Lamborghinis, a estate.
Is there a bankruptcy estate collecting these assets?
Your Honor, before the indictment, the government talked to Mr. Okun's defense counsel and got the defendant to agree to transfer all of his assets to the bankruptcy estate. The companies had been placed into bankruptcy approximately, I think it was 11 days after the search warrant. But as far as his personal assets, the bankruptcy trustee did get those. We seized the remaining.
That's what, in California? Where's the bankruptcy?
I believe that the bankruptcy was filed in the Southern District of New York, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. But the sentence is reasonable. It was procedurally reasonable, substantively reasonable, and quite frankly, there's no other sentence. There could be other sentences that would be reasonable. You could have a 50-year sentence that would have made sure that Mr. Okun spent his entire life in jail, but that might not have led to the general deterrence message. The judge said 400 years could have been reasonable if you looked at other sentences, but he picked 100 years. And there's absolutely no reason for this court to reverse that sentence under an abuse of discretion standard. As far as the Franks hearing, the court's correct. Even if Mr. Okun could get by the standing issue, which this court has not determined a standing issue for a sole owner of a corporation in circumstances like this, but even if he could get...
Well, that to me is a complicated issue, especially when the argument is that he ignored corporate form and assets and really treated the whole enterprise as his private sector.
Your Honor, but
quite apart from that, I don't understand why we're wasting anything. The question is whether the search warrant is supported by probable cause or whether it was undermined by conduct.
And, Your Honor, the district court's factual findings in these are exhaustive, and as a practical matter, he found that
the court did reach the merits of it.
He did, Your Honor. Finally, given Mr. Protegiaro's concession that he did not find one count in the indictment that he would challenge as insufficient for the court, looking at the continuance motion, it is a deferential abuse of discretion. The only other thing I would find say about that, Your Honors, is that there was absolutely no allegation in any of the briefing, nor could there be, that there was a specific prejudice that it would have enabled the defense to do anything differently.
Well, in long trials, the normal prejudice is preparing for a witness. And the judge requires the parties for this witness. I must say a very good practice in long trials. In any case, the judge did impose that for lack of witness.
And in fact, Your Honor, it wasn't just the witness list because the defense had had that ever since the government's
No, the order of the witnesses.
The order of the witnesses. Yes. Yeah. If there are no other questions,
Mr. Dry.
Thank you.
Mr. Proto, is it Giro or Giro? I thought Giro.
I don't have anything else to add in rebuttal, unless the court has anything they were
Mr. Proto Giro, I notice you are court appointed, and I want to acknowledge that publicly and thank you for your service. We'll come down and recount and take a short recess.